Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening, depending upon where you are in the world. This is Walter Davis with Progress in the World Radio Show, coming to you from beautiful Southern California. And today we have a very special treat in that we're going to be having a discussion about judicial corruption and things that we can do to hold our judiciary accountable with Brian Vukadinovich from Indiana. He's an author, he's a speaker, and he's an educator. He's a retired educator and author of two books now, Motion for Justice, I Rest My Case, and Rogues and Black Robes. He has litigated several civil and criminal cases successfully, representing himself without a lawyer, winning several dismissals of bogus and vindictive retaliatory criminal charges against him. He's brought to public light information evidence of judicial corruption in cases that he's litigated involving civil rights cases, appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, and submitted evidence of case fixing. So we're going to be looking at corruption. We've already seen recently things happening on the Supreme Court where justices have been getting kickbacks and corruption, and that permeates all the way down to our local level. So we're going to be having a discussion about that. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks, Walter. It's a pleasure to be on. Thanks for the invitation.
Most certainly. So I'm very excited about this show. And why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? You talk about yourself to our guest.
Yes, I was born in Chicago back in the day, and I'm a little bit older now. I'm 71 now. Early on, my mom wanted to live out in the country, so we moved out to Indiana, and you know, we lived a good life out here for a long period of time and so forth. And then I was a teacher. I went to college, became a teacher and a basketball coach. I coached, my dream was to be a college basketball coach. That was my dream in life. And I coached in high school for a long time, then I did make it to the college level, and everything was going great in my life until 1981. Me and my mom were at a bank in Valparaiso, Indiana. It was a Saturday morning. We're going to go out and do some shopping and so forth. So we stopped at the bank, and this is how this entire ordeal started with me. And then we walk into the bank, and shortly after we entered the bank, the police swarmed in, grabbed me, threw me against a wall, roughed me up pretty good. I had no idea what was going on, and I was trying to get them off of me asking them, what are you doing here? And so forth, and the bank people were trying to explain to them that they had the wrong person. What had happened, I guess, a few moments before we went into the bank, there had been some kind of problem out in the parking lot in the bank, and the police were called, and they went crazy. They went in there, and then they just grabbed me. They assumed it was me somehow. I don't know if it was, you know, they might have had an identification with another person that might have looked like me or something. Who knows? But they went crazy. They were out of control. The bank people were trying to explain to them, you got the wrong person here, and so forth. And they were just crazy, so out of control. And then when they finally realized that they had the wrong person, rather than simply apologizing and let me go, they thought, oh, boy, well, we better hit them with something now or we're going to be in trouble. We're going to have to somehow justify what we just did. So then they hit me with a bogus disorderly conduct charge. So at the time, you know, I was just a teacher, basketball coach. I didn't really know much about the law. That was not really much interest to me and so forth. I just wanted to be a teacher and a coach, knew nothing about the law, so I had to hire a lawyer. So I hire a lawyer, we went to court, and the judge heard the evidence. I testified, my mom testified, the police testified, and then the judge was very, very upset at the police for what they did. He found me not guilty, and he severely admonished the police. He said to the police, "What's wrong with you people? You realize you had the wrong person here. You should have just simply apologized and let him go, and you put him through this." So then he found me not guilty, and then I sued him. I received an out-of-court settlement, and then it became news. It was in the local newspapers and so forth. And then the police chief, this was the Valparaiso, Indiana Police Department. So then the police chief of the Valparaiso Police Department, his name was Richard Buchanan. He was the chief at the time. Then he makes a public statement in the newspaper that his officers did no wrong, that there should not have been an out-of-court settlement, that I should not have received any money from what happened, and so forth. So that right there was a signal to the Valparaiso PD. You know, we can probably pretty much do whatever we want because our police chief is going to be behind us no matter what we do, whether it's right or wrong, he's going to support us. So then after that, my life became a living nightmare. I mean, I couldn't go to the grocery store without getting arrested. And then a while after, I get stopped again. The very same police officer, his name was William Collins, and throws me up against the hood of his police car. And again, I'm trying to figure out what's going on, what are you doing to me, and so forth. So he's roughing me up pretty good. He's got me up on top of the hood of the police car. So I made my way away from him, and I went into the store. I thought, well, I gotta call my brother if I can possibly get a hold of him real quick here so I can tell him what's going on, because I didn't have any idea what was going to happen to me. So I get into – and on my way into the store, there was a young lady who was working for the store. She was taking groceries out for a customer, and she said to me, "Are you okay?" And then I went into the store, and that was a very important thing because I needed her as a witness later. So I went into the store, and I tried to call my brother, and the police came in and grabbed the phone out of my hand and handcuffed me in front of a store full of people. You know, the people probably were thinking I was trying maybe to even rob the store or something. Who knows? But it looked bad. So then they put me in the back seat of the police car, and there was a German Shepherd police dog in the back seat. I'm handcuffed behind my back. This German Shepherd is gritting his teeth at me and growling. And nobody else is in the car. I mean, if he would have attacked me, I mean, there was no way I could have defended myself. So then they take me to jail, book me in, charge me with resisting arrest and some type of a bogus driving charge of some kind that was bogus. So we go back to court again, and the same judge, and he throws it out. So then I file another false arrest brutality lawsuit against the Valparaiso PD. Again, I received an out-of-court settlement. And then after that, forget it. I could not get in the car and go to the grocery store. I got arrested 10 times after that. Never been arrested before that. And then I got arrested 10 times. And then the word got out between the police departments and the surrounding area and so forth. And then they started writing letters. Police chiefs were writing letters to the prosecutors between the counties about how they were going to get me. So then I couldn't even go into the next county over. Then I would get arrested and have to go through all of that nonsense 10 times. So then I filed a civil rights lawsuit in federal court. And I had this, so I had all of the information in there and the evidence about what the Valparaiso Police Department was doing to me and so forth. So we have, at this point now, and I should probably back up here a little bit and discuss a little bit about the lawyer situation. Well, it was bleeding me dry. It was costing so much money to hire lawyers to defend me in these criminal cases and so forth. And then it got to the point where I started noticing some very shaky things with the lawyers and how they were approaching things and not really giving me a very vigorous defense as I believe I should have been getting and so forth, and yet they're collecting all this money from me. So then I decided to start doing a little legal research, and this is how I started learning the law. I had three separate charges, not charges, but cases filed against me by the Valparaiso PD and also the Porter County Sheriff's Department, which I actually went to trial for and was acquitted of their bogus charge as well. So I have these three charges, bogus cases filed against me by the Valparaiso PD that are still pending, for one of them was a couple of years old, and then the other one were a few months old and so forth. So their game was, let's keep arresting Vukadinovich. He won't be able to keep paying for lawyers. He's going to end up having troubles on the job and so forth. So that was their goal. That was their mission. That was quite obvious. So then I went to the law library, and I did some research, and then I ran across the law in Indiana. It was a speedy trial rule where when you're prosecuted, now every state has the speedy trial rule, and we're seeing this now a lot on TV with all this stuff with Trump and his cohorts and so forth, where the speedy trial rule is being, you know, invoked and so forth. So I found out, I learned that there was a speedy trial rule in Indiana, and it stated, I believe it was either 60 days or 180 days. I can't remember which one it was. But as I said, one of those cases was well over a year old, and it was still pending. So the law stated that when a person is arrested and prosecuted in Indiana, that they must be brought to trial within that time period. And if not, the charges must be dismissed. So when I saw that law, I went to my lawyer's office the very next morning. So I walked in there, and I said, hey, I have a question for you. And I said, listen, I did a little bit of research, and all I want you to do is tell me if I'm right or wrong about my interpretation of this law. So I stated the law to him about the time period and the charge had to be dismissed and so forth if the prosecution wasn't brought. And he said to me, well, it's not that easy. And I said to him, I did not ask you if it was easy, if it was going to be easy. I asked you if that was what the law was. Well, it's not that easy. I'm handling things here. I said, well, if that is in fact the law, then you're really not handling things here. So I said to him, I will expect you by the end of the business day tomorrow to file motions to dismiss all three of those cases based on that law. And he said, well, that's not going to happen. It's much more complicated than that. I said, no, it's very cut and dry. The law is very clear on this. So I said, well, if you're not going to do it, then I will file the motions myself. And I'll never forget his exact words to me. He said, you're not filing a damn thing. Those were his exact words. So I said to him, well, you are fired. You're done. You're history. You are no longer representing me. So then I walked out and went home. My brother asked me how the meeting went, and I told him. I explained to him what happened. I told him I fired the lawyer. He said he wouldn't file the dismissal papers. So my brother said, well, what are you going to do then? I said, well, I'm going to file them on my own. So back in those days, there was no computers and so forth. This was back in the early 80s. And as far as now, what we have with things we do, we can type, you know, and do those things. I had to do it on my old Smith Corona typewriter, my old college typewriter. So I did it separately. You had to do it three times separately on the typewriter. So I type it up. I put the law in. I put in the dates of the false arrests and so forth, and I file them myself. And then lo and behold, guess what? The judge grants all three of my motions and dismisses all three of the cases. Now think about it. I'm paying a lawyer. His job is to defend me. His job is to know what the law is and have that law enforced. And then when I brought it to his attention, he basically told me to jump in the lake. He wouldn't do it. So I'm thinking, well, there's a lot going on here behind the scenes then. If he was incompetent and didn't know what that law was, I certainly explained it to him, and it was been easy for him to look up. But it was very clear to me that he just opposed having these lawyers. They make a lot of money when you come in, you pay them money, the cases drag on, you got to keep paying the money. That's how these lawyers operate. So from that point on, I said, that's it. No more lawyers for me. So then I went out and I bought myself a law dictionary just so I would understand what the terms were and so forth. I started studying the terms and so forth. And then I got arrested several times after that by Valparaiso PD and their compadres in the various local departments and so forth. And then one occasion, I'm driving down the street, not right a couple blocks away from where I lived on Roosevelt Road in Valparaiso, and there was a particular Valparaiso police officer that lived on that street, and I'd see him outside in his yard, and he'd see me driving by. His name was Richard Zentz. So then one day, I'm coming home from work. I was a school teacher, and it was in October, and it was 4:27 p.m. in the afternoon. Got finished with school. It was about a 45-minute drive home. So it was about 4:27 p.m. I get stopped, and all of a sudden, I'm just swarmed by police cars with their red lights on and so forth. So then I'm asking them, what are you doing here? Why are you stopping me? Why are you doing this to me? And then keep your mouth shut and all of that. It was horrible to have these days we've seen what happened with George Floyd and so forth. So the public has a pretty well good understanding now about what goes on behind the scenes. Now back in those days there were no cell phones as there are today, so that made it a little bit tougher to prove the cases. So then what they didn't know, I had a tape recorder in the car. I'd been arrested so many times, I said, I'm going to have to, it's hard to really prove these cases because it's your word against the police if you don't have any independent witnesses. And a lot of times people don't want to get involved and you don't even know who the witnesses are. So I tape recorded them. And I caught them right on the tape laughing and F him, I'm going to get the son of a bitch. And they're all standing around laughing. And I had it all on the tape recording. So then they arrest me, book me in. I had to go through all of the stuff again. Then they prosecuted me, file the charges against me, and so forth. And then about 2 weeks later, the same cop, Richard Zentz, Valparaiso PD, about 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later maybe, he sees me again on the same street on Roosevelt Road. He follows me, and he stops me. I was about 3 blocks away from my house. So he stops me, and I said, hey, what are you doing here? What's going on here? What are you doing? Leave me alone, and so forth. Keep your mouth shut. Let me see your driver's license. So I show him my license and so forth. Well, you're not supposed to be driving. You have a suspended license. I said, my license is not suspended. This is all nonsense, and you know it. I said, I'm tired of this. I'm going home. So I went home. I drove home. I was about 3 blocks away, and then police cars all over. He radioed all of his buddies in, and police cars all over the place in my neighborhood. They grabbed me, the hell out of me. And my neighbors are all watching. My mom, my brother, they're trying to get help me and so forth. And they threatened them with arrest, and then they throw me in the back seat of the squad car. And this Valparaiso officer, his name was Ronald Kermis, I'm handcuffed behind my back, and he has his knees, pressing his knee into my back all the way to the police station. And I couldn't breathe. I honestly thought I was going to die. So this time, the other arrest, they took me to the jail, to the sheriff's department, and they would book me in there. But this time, they took me to the Valparaiso Police Department first. Worked me over in there, same old stuff, against the wall, got their hands all over my face, pushing me into the wall and so forth. And then they take me over to the sheriff's department and book me in, and they charge me with resisting arrest, and that was all. So then I asked the jailers, no, I got to back up. They brought me in, but no charges were filed, and I asked the jailer, why am I here? What are the charges? He said, well, they haven't filed the charges yet. They'll be here later on with the charges. So then, a few hours later, they come to the jail, and they put the charges in, and they put the charge of speeding in as the charge, as the basis to stop me, and then they also hit me with resisting arrest and fleeing and that nonsense. So, which was kind of unusual, because usually when they book you in, they charge you right then. So they figured, well, you know, what is the actual reason? We have to have a reason that we actually stopped them. So then we go to court. We go to court on the criminal charges. I'm representing myself, and we have a hearing. And the first hearing we had, and I should back up for a minute here. When they took me to jail on that particular arrest, it was on November 3rd, 1986, they went back to the same judge again who we'd already been to court with twice already, and he'd already admonished them, and then he threw the other cases out against me, and he threw them out on their ears out of his courtroom. He told them, get out. I'm not having this nonsense anymore. His name was Judge Bryce Billings. He was actually a good judge. He was an honest judge, actually. He knew what was going on. He didn't play the game like a lot of these judges do these days. So then he threw them out. He would not allow them to file the charges. So then they went to Portage, Indiana, roughly a half hour away. So they go to Portage, Indiana. They're looking for a court to file charges in. So they file it in Portage. So then I go to my first hearing, and I asked the judge, why this happened in Valparaiso, why am I being prosecuted here in Portage? Why is that? And then the judge said to the prosecutor, her name was Nancy Vedic, well, explain that. That's a good question, actually. Why is the charge being brought out here? Well, and then the prosecutor, Vedic, she tells the judge was Judge Mary Harper. He said, Judge Harper, the judge in Valparaiso, Judge Billings, transferred this case here. He had it transferred here. So then I told the judge, I said, that is a total lie, and this prosecutor knows that's a lie because Judge Billings threw him out of his courtroom. He told him he didn't want any more nonsense coming into his courtroom, and this was not transferred. And then the prosecutor, Vedic, it's coming back to me now. The judge actually did not accept the charges. That's why they brought the charges out here. So that was a big lie right there. And that judge right then and there knew something was up here. So then the next hearing, we have another hearing. And, again, I'm representing myself. And I filed a motion for evidence. I wanted police reports, letters that have been written about me between various police officials and so forth. And there were also some pictures that were taken of me when they were roughing me up at the police station, which they didn't want to turn over to me. So I filed a motion for that evidence, for the production of that evidence. And there's a law. It's a universal law, basically. It's Brady versus Maryland. The prosecutors are required under Brady versus Maryland, it's a Supreme Court precedent, to turn over all exculpatory information to defendants. It's a requirement by the Supreme Court. So I filed my motions for that evidence, which they weren't turning over to me, and because they wouldn't turn the information over to me, I filed a motion to compel the evidence, the production of the evidence. So we have a hearing on it. So then Judge Harper conducts a hearing, and she says, okay, Mr. Vukadinovich, it's your motion. Explain your motion. So I explained to the judge. I said, Judge, they've got pictures that they took. They're going to show how they roughed, you know, their face, their hands are in my faces, pushing me against the wall, and so forth. And also, I told her that they had written letters about me and received the letters about me from other local law enforcement officials, prosecutors and police chiefs and so forth, about how they're going to get me. This is how we're going to get Vukadinovich. We're on board on this thing together. Let me know how we can help and so forth. So there was definitely a conspiracy taking place for sure. It was clearly in letters. What they didn't know, what they did not know was that I had those letters. I had copies of those letters because I had filed a federal litigation in another federal court in South Bend, Indiana, and they just didn't do their homework and they didn't know about it. So I got a lot of that information from that federal case. So I had those letters. So then the judge says to the prosecutor, same prosecutor, Nancy Vadek, well, he says there's letters written about him, and Vadek says to the judge, he's blowing smoke. There's been no letters that Porter County officials have written about him, and there's been no letters that have been received about him from any other law enforcement agencies. He's blowing smoke. It's not true. So I said to the judge, Judge, this prosecutor just lied to you. I know there were letters written about me and by various law enforcement officials into Porter County here and out of Porter County. And she says, well, Mr. Vukadinovich, I can't order the state to produce information that they say they don't have. And I said, well, for the record here, there were letters written and the state just lied to you. So she set it for trial, and then I asked her for 5 subpoenas, and she asked me what I needed the subpoenas for, who I needed them for. So I told her, I said, well, I want one for the sheriff of Porter County, I want one for the prosecutor of LaPorte County, I want one from this particular prosecutor in Porter County, and so forth. Several, there were 5 of them. So she gave me the subpoenas, and then I served all of those. They were sheriff, prosecutors, and police, and so forth. So I served them all. There were 5 of them. And we're ready for trial now. I served them so they would have to appear so I could put them on the stand and question them. So what they knew at that point, they figured out, well, you know, he must have those letters. Otherwise, he wouldn't be pressing this like he is. He's going to put the sheriff on the stand. He's going to put the police chief on the stand. He's going to put the prosecutors on the stand. So then we have a hearing not long before the trial was scheduled. So then the judge, she makes a ruling on the case. She looks at a deposition. I took the cop's deposition. And she rules that the Valparaiso police did not have probable cause to stop me, to detain me, or to arrest me. So she threw all the charges out because they all knew that I was going to make mincemeat out of them at the trial. I was going to put them on the stand. I'd already got the prosecutor in the hearing lying to the judge that there were no letters written and so forth, and then I was going to put them on the stand, and I was going to put the letters in their hand, and it was going to be bad news for them for sure. So then she dismissed it. And then we ended up, and then a couple of years later, I believe it was in 1992, I filed a federal lawsuit for civil rights violations, for conspiracy, false arrests, and brutalities and so forth. It was in Hammond in U.S. District Court. This judge's name was James Moody. So we have all the discovery taking place before the trial, and I knew that there were a lot of problems with the Valparaiso PD. They had arrested and brutalized plenty of other people before me. I read a lot of articles that were in the newspaper and so forth. So then during the federal litigation, I requested in the federal litigation and discovery evidence of all of the false arrests that have taken place and brutalities by the Valparaiso Police Department. So Moody ordered that the information be submitted. It's called in camera for him to look at. So then, but not me. So he orders them to turn it over, and then he looks at it, and then he eventually allowed me to see the evidence. So then I made copies of everything because I wanted to call these people into the trial as witnesses on what the police did to them so I can show the pattern of practice and so forth of it. So then there's a police officer, a former police officer of the Valparaiso Police Department. He had told my brother ran into him in that same restaurant of Valparaiso where they had stopped me for that bogus arrest for the no headlights being on and so forth. And he told my brother, he said, boy, I really hated to see what happened with your brother. I got out of that place. It was just misery to work in. I heard them talking about your brother all the time, how they were going to falsely arrest him and beat him up and so forth. So he told my brother all this stuff. His name was John Kuros. So now he was retired at the time, just maybe a couple of years at that point. So then I went out there to see him, to talk to him. And I said, John, you've got to testify. I have a federal trial coming up. Please, you have to come in and testify and tell the jury about this. Well, I can't. If I do, you know, we know how they operate. I'm just not going to be able to. I can't do it. I'm sorry. So I went back out a couple of more times and talked to him. You know, I just pleaded with him. Please, John, you have to do this. We have to get this out to the jury so they know what happened behind the scenes. So then, eventually, he said, you know what? I got to do this. I got to do the right thing here. This has got to stop. So, Mo, I felt really good now. Now I've got all this information about their prior arrests against other people. I've got evidence of the pattern and practice of abusing citizens' rights during false arrests. I've got a former retired police officer of that department who was going to come in and testify that he had heard the Valparaiso police, how they were scheming to falsely arrest me and beat me up and so forth. And so now we have the trial. So now we're in trial. And then I want to introduce the evidence of the prior false arrests and brutalities against other people to show the custom of the Valparaiso Police Department in abusing citizens' civil rights, which under the law you're allowed to do. And actually you're expected to do it if you have a case of pattern and practice. You have to show the information, the evidence about what took place before they did it to you. That's the law. And he would not allow any of that information to come into the jury. He would not allow any reports to come into the jury. He would not allow any of those, because I subpoenaed a couple of people that were brutalized to testify. He would not allow them to come on. You know, all this nonsense that judges are able to use where they want to actually stick it to the public when they're protecting governments and corporations. There's a lot of judges out there that are doing that. We'll talk about that, I think, later on. So then I try to introduce the tape recording of the October arrest where they're laughing on there, and they stated on there, F him, I'm going to get the son of a bitch. And he would not allow me to introduce that tape into evidence. So the jury never heard that tape. So he did not allow the jury to hear the other people testify about what the police did to them. He did not allow me to put that tape recording in the evidence so the jury could actually hear that tape recording and hear them laughing about how they're going to get me. Wouldn't do it. Wouldn't allow it. So then... I call John Kuros to the witness stand, and then the Valparaiso Police Department's lawyer objects. I said, well, how could this be objected to? He's a direct witness to conversations. It's not hearsay. He heard the conversations directly, how they were going to falsely arrest me, how they were going to brutalize me. He heard the whole scheme taking place, and Moody, again, would not let me put that former Valparaiso police officer on the stand so he could tell the jury what he heard with his own ears. So, needless to say, the jury ruled in the Valparaiso Police Department's favor. They didn't hear any of that evidence at all. None. He would not allow it. So then I take it to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago, the Federal Court of Appeals. So I brief everything. I submit all of the information into the appeals court. They saw, I had the transcripts. Transcripts cost a lot of money. I had the transcripts of the trial so I could show the appellate court the rulings that Moody made and so forth, where he wouldn't allow me to put the evidence and the witness testimony in into evidence. And then the Seventh Circuit determined that, well, yeah, the police officer Curls was on the witness list, on the pretrial order on the witness list. It was not objected to. And by the way, I should add, in a federal civil rights trial, or even in a state a civil rights trial, when there is a pretrial order entered in the case, that becomes what they call the law of the case. All the arguments are made between the parties, and the judge then, everybody has to sign off on it at the end. The judge has to sign his name on the pretrial order, and the parties have to sign their name to it. So everything was signed off on. Curls was a witness. That was signed off on. The tape recording was listed as evidence, not objected to. That was signed off on. So that was the law of the case. So then when I argued that to the Supreme Court or to the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, they said, well, yes, Vukadinovich is correct. Those things were listed on the pretrial order. That's true. However, we like to give deference to the trial courts, and it was harmless error, they called it. Harmless error. So how could you possibly say in a civil rights case not allowing witnesses to testify and direct evidence of a tape recording that disallowance of evidence would be a harmless error? They acknowledged it was error. But to cover the judge, they deemed it to be harmless error. So, of course, they affirmed all of, you know, Moody's infected rulings. So, now, I'm going to fast forward. So, years later now, and in the meantime, I'm getting fired from teaching jobs, from all these police things, and so forth. So my life was just misery from this. So then I was able to get a teaching job at Hanover Community School Corporation, taught there for 8 years, and as I said, I'd previously lost a couple of teaching jobs before that, and over all of this stuff. So then everything is moving along great with my teaching job. I had a great principal. Joe Fetty was his name. He was the principal for 28 years at the school there. He was great. He hired me in. And then he retired and then got another good principal that came in. He was great, but then they got rid of him. And then they hired this principal out of Hammond. His name was Justin Biggs. His first year there, had never been a principal before. So then he calls me in at the end of the school year. And he says to me, well, you're not coming back here. I'm giving you your notice that you're not going to be back here. We're doing a reduction in force. It's a RIF, reduction in force. We're going to reduce the teaching force here. So I said, well, I'm not buying it. And I said, I want a meeting with the school board. So the school board rejected my request for a meeting. So right away, under your constitutional rights, you have a right to due process. This was public employment. I was employed as a teacher in a public school corporation, so your due process rights come into play under the 14th Amendment. So the school board said, no, we're not going to give you a meeting with us. You can take everything up with the superintendent. The superintendent will answer all your questions. I said, well, that's not right. The superintendent is rubber stamping the principal's recommendation. And so forth. So I knew there was something going on behind the scenes. Now, this particular principal, Biggs, he came in from Hammond, and I had tried to get a job in Hammond a couple of years earlier, and Hammond refused to hire me. All of this is happening because of the police stuff that was on my record. They won't admit that, but that's why those were the reasons. There's no question that's why they wouldn't hire me, these school corporations. So then they hired a non-qualified person that didn't even have a teaching license for the area, and I had a master's degree in the area. So I filed a federal lawsuit against them, and I won. I received an out-of-court settlement, and also another school corporation, Crown Point, that also likewise wouldn't hire me. So they both had to pay. We were set for trial, so they ended up paying me $100,000. So I won the federal cases against those schools. So then Hanover, everything is going great, and then here comes the guy from Hammond where they would not hire me, and he made a comment to me about, well, I hope you save some of that settlement money from Hammond. I have friends in Hammond, you know, and all of that nonsense. So then I file a federal lawsuit against Hanover, and then we go to trial. This happened in 2012. I received my walking papers in 2012. I filed a federal lawsuit. It took 4 years for it to get into trial. Had to take it to the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, first. That's the law. So then they gave me a right to sue letter, and then finally, 4 years later, 2016, we go to trial. So we go to trial. I'm representing myself. The corporation has a battery of lawyers. And so I put my former principal on the stand, who testified on my behalf. He did a great job. There was no reason, you know, that he should have been let go and so forth. And he'd been a principal there for 28 years. And then I put Biggs on the stand, and I put the school board members on the stand, and I put the superintendent on the stand. And they just lied out of their teeth, and the jury saw right through it. So then, to make a long story short, we're on the fifth day of the trial now. It was a five-day jury trial. So the fifth day, we're all finished, and one of the school's corporation's lawyers stands up and said, I call Mary Joan Dixon to the stand. And I was just surprised. I was kind of shocked. Trial was basically over, and I thought, what are you putting her back on? I already made mincemeat out of her one time in this trial. Now you're going to put her back on? So what's she going to have to say? So then here's what happened. Mary Joan Dixon was the president of the school board, so she puts her back on the stand, and she said, well, I have a few questions for you. She said, now, Ms. Dixon, you were the president of the school board at the time, correct? She said, yes. She said, now, did Mr. Vukadinovich receive all of the due process that he was entitled to? And Dixon said, yes. Then she said, my next question is, did Ms. Kaiser, the superintendent, did she answer all of Mr. Vukadinovich's questions when she met with him? And Dixon said, yes. And then she said, okay, last question here. Did Ms. Kaiser provide all of the evidence that Mr. Vukadinovich requested? And Dixon again said yes. Now remember now, she said yes when she was asked if Kaiser answered all of my questions. So now I get a chance to do cross-examination. And to be honest about it, I couldn't wait to get up to the podium. So I said, now, Ms. Dixon, I said, now, your lawyer called you back up here and asked you three questions, and you answered yes to each one of those questions. I said, now, I'm going to ask you about each one of those three questions. When your lawyer asked you if Ms. Kaiser provided all of the due process that I was entitled to under the law, you said yes. Is that correct? She said yes. Then I said, and then she asked you if Ms. Kaiser provided all of the information that I asked for, and you said yes. Is that correct? And Dixon says yes. And I said, and then your lawyer asked you if Ms. Kaiser answered all of my questions at the meeting with her that I had with her, and you answered yes. Is that correct? She said yes. So I said, well, now I have a question for you. Were you at the meeting with me and Ms. Kaiser, the superintendent? Were you there? She said, no. And then I said, well, if you weren't there at the meeting with me and the superintendent, how do you know if she answered all of my questions? How do you know that? How would you know that? And she looked down and didn't answer. So I said to the judge, it was Judge Philip Simon, he was the chief judge at the time, I said, Judge, please instruct her to answer the question. So he instructed her. He said, you got to answer the question. So I said, I'm going to ask you again. If you were not at the meeting with me and the superintendent, Kaiser, how would you have known if she didn't answer my questions? How do you know that? How would you know that? And then she looked down, and you could barely hear her answer. She said, well, I guess I don't know. You could barely hear her. And I said, could you please repeat that a little bit louder? Well, I guess I don't know. I said, well, then I said to her, well, I guess you just lied. You just lied. And then I turned around and I went back to my table and we were done. So the jury heard how the superintendent lied and how the school board president lied. The superintendent actually testified to the jury. She testified to the jury that I did not ask her for the actual reason that I was being let go. Now, who's going to believe that? So then when I did my closing argument, I said to the jury, I said, now, you remember when the superintendent told you that I did not ask her for the reason that I lost my job? That was the purpose of the meeting, actually, to find out the reason, what was going on. I said, you heard her say that to you. I said to the jury, you've seen me in here now. You've watched me for the week here, 5 days now. So I said to the jury, do I look like the type of person that does not ask questions? Do I look like the kind of person that doesn't ask questions? And they knew that because I was really grilling them pretty hard during the trial. So the jurors knew, well, you know, we saw him in action here. Obviously, he would have asked the superintendent for the reason. So I'm going to fast forward here. So I said to the, let me back up just for a second. We were both given 50 minutes, 5-0, 50 minutes for closing argument. And as the plaintiff, you can divide it up. You can go first, and then you can go last if you choose to, or you can do yours all at one time if you want. So you're kind of foolish if you don't divide it up, actually, because you want to have the last word. So I told the judge I wanted 30 minutes for my first time, and then they would do their 50-minute oral argument, and then I went back up for my last 20 minutes. So the first time I went up, I took my legal pad with me. I had all my, you know, notes on there. I talked about evidence and so forth. And when I went up the second time, I did not take a notepad up there with me. I just spoke from the heart. I said to the jurors, look what they did to me. I did a good job. You heard all the testimony from the principals and so forth. You saw the evaluations. There was no need for this. And clearly this was retaliation because of what, you know, this guy that came in from Hammond and so forth. And all of a sudden then I lose my job from a guy that came in from a corporation that wouldn't hire me. And then he becomes my principal. So I said, you heard the school board president right at the very end of the trial lie to you when she testified that Kaiser, the superintendent, answered all my questions. And then when I asked her how she would know that if she was not at the meeting, she then admitted that she did not know. So you heard her lie to you. Well, then the judge says to me, he says, 1 minute. He had already, you know, told us ahead of time, I'm going to tell you when you have 5 minutes and 1 minute left and 30 seconds left. So then he says to me, 30 seconds, Mr. Vukadinovich. This stuff in federal court is real strict, how they do things. So he said, 30 seconds. So I did not plan this out. This was just immediately. It was just impromptu. I turned around and I pointed at their table, their lawyers and the school officials. I took my left hand and I pointed at the table, and I said to the jury, look at them. Look at these liars who lied to you this entire week. Look at these liars. Look at them. And I could see the judge out of the corner of my eye, and I thought, well, is he going to say anything, or is the other lawyer going to object? The judge didn't say anything. He was fine with it. But I thought, well, the lawyer might object. But the lawyer knew if she objected, that if the judge would have overruled her objection, that would not have looked good in front of the jury. So she had to gamble a little bit. Well, maybe he'll sustain it. But if he doesn't, it's going to look bad if the judge says overruled. So she didn't object. So that's how the trial ended. My closing argument, I pointed at their table. I kept my hand out, pointed at them, and I called them liars. And then we were done. So they went into deliberations, and we were out in the hallway. About 2.5 hours went by, and this was on a Friday. Now the trial started on Monday, and then the trial. So then the judge came out. So when I saw the judge, I thought, oh boy, he's going to probably ask us to come back on Monday, because it was starting to get into the evening now and so forth. And I really wanted the verdict to come in that same day, because it was a real big effect that I knew was going to happen from right at the end of the trial when the school board president lied. When some time goes by, it loses its effect a little bit. So I thought, but if that's what he wants to do, he's the judge. So then he approached both sides and he said, hey, here's what we're going to do. We're going to send him to dinner now, and we're going to tell him that they are allowed to deliberate over dinner if they so choose. They don't have to, but if they so choose, they can deliberate and talk about the case. And then after dinner, they're going to come back and deliberate, and we're going to try to get this verdict tonight if we can. So I thought, boy, that's great. That's what I was hoping to hear. So then about an hour later, his court officer came out to the hallway, and I thought, oh, boy, this time for sure they're going to say we're coming back Monday. There's no verdict. So then she came out, and she told us the judge wants everybody back in the courtroom. There's a note from the jury that the judge has to read to you. So we go back into the courtroom, and the judge says, I have a note from the jury. And he reads the note, and he said, the jurors told the judge that they needed a calculator. So now, obviously, what would the jurors need a calculator for? They're going to determine damages. It was right then and then. Everybody knew I won the case. So then he read the note, the jury note, and then he asked both sides, do you object I'm going to tell the jury, I'm going to give them the calculator and so forth. Are there any objections? Well, they knew they couldn't object. There was no basis to object to that. And then, of course, I didn't object. It was welcome news to me. So then they deliberated for about another hour. We went back in, and then none of the school officials came back. They were there the entire week. And I'm sure their lawyers told them, you don't have to be in, because they knew they lost. You don't have to be in here. We'll take care of this and so forth. So then the jury awarded me a little over $200,000, $204,000 and some change, $204,000 and something. So I win the case. It's in all the news and so forth. And then their lawyers contacted me. Hey, listen, we're going to appeal this. Are you willing to go lower on the judgment? I said, absolutely not. I said, go ahead and appeal if you want. You're going to lose the appeal. I'm going to embarrass you at the appeal, on the appeal, just as I embarrassed you at this trial. Have fun. So I said, no. So then they knew they had no chance. So then I ended up, they had to pay. So it was all over the news and so forth. Now, fast forwarding now again. Now, Judge Richard Posner was actually on the panel that decided against me in that police case in 1992 with the Valparaiso police. So then he contacts me and said, hey, I read about how you won that civil rights case on your own without a lawyer and so forth, and the congratulations and all of this and all of that. And he said to me, I had already known, I already saw in the news, Posner was a federal court of appeals judge in Chicago for a little over 36 years, one of the most well-known federal judges in the country. If anybody Googles his name, you're going to see all kinds of stuff in there. He came close to getting on the Supreme Court. So then he got upset on his 36th year. He had a case, and it was a pro se case. I think the person was in jail, and they were abusing him in jail and so forth. And the other judges basically didn't want to, consider the case, basically. Case closed. We're not going to allow any relief for this person here. So Poser said, well, what do you mean? You guys can't just look the other way with this thing. We have to make a determination here. This person was wronged. So then they pretty much ignored Posner, and then he got mad, and then after 36 years, he quit the bench. He retired, and it was all over the news, and it was in the New York Times and all over the place where he said, I awoken after a slumber of 36 years, and I realized how the judges here at the Seventh Circuit are abusing the pro ses. And his exact words were, the judges here on the Seventh Circuit consider the pro ses as trash. Those were his words. They consider the pro ses to be trash. Now, for your audience, pro ses means a person that represents himself or herself without a lawyer in court. So then he founded a company. He started a company called the Posner Center of Justice for Pro Ses. So then when he read about my case and he contacted me and he asked me, hey, listen, would you be willing, you know, with what you did at your trial, you could come, you know, you could actually help a lot here. I'm starting this new company and we're going to help pro ses who don't have lawyers who are trying to manage their cases, and you could be a great help. Would you be willing to do that? So I thought to myself, well, you know, this is a guy that was actually on that panel that ruled against me in that police case. Now, we didn't talk about that. So, I was a little uneasy about it. But then again, I had read where he denounced the other judges on the Seventh Circuit and publicly denounced them and said that they, you know, and he put it out there to the public that they considered the pro ses to be trash and so forth. So I thought, well, you know what, let me give them the benefit of the doubt here. And then, so we communicated a little bit further and so forth. And then at that exact time period, I was just finishing my first book, Motion for Justice, I Rest My Case. So then I asked him, so then I agreed to come to work for him at the Posner Center, and then I asked him if he would write the foreword to my book, and he did. So he wrote the foreword to my first book, Motion for Justice, I Rest My Case, and then I went to work for him, and I went up, and he invited me to Chicago. We had several lunches and dinners and so forth. We had several meetings and so forth, and then we became good friends, actually. He called me a lot. We talked a lot on the phone. We emailed a lot. And he told me a lot of things, you know, that were going on, you know, that were just bad news in the court system, and particularly in the Seventh Circuit. So we became very good friends. So then he disclosed to me, he had already publicly disclosed how upset he was and how the judges at the Seventh Circuit were treating the pro ses. And he didn't talk about any individual cases other than that one that caused him to resign, to retire at the end. So then he disclosed to me, discreetly to me, that this judge, Caney, Michael Caney, who actually only lives about a half hour away from me here in Indiana, he was on the Seventh Circuit, how Caney approached Posner. Caney was not on that panel, but Posner was on my panel with the police, and asked him to have the case fixed. Decided against me. Don't rule in Vukadinovich's favor. So Posner told me that this was something that judges did from time to time. They did favors to one another and so forth. And we were on the bench together for a long time and so forth. So I went ahead and did it. And he apologized to me and so forth and asked for my forgiveness and so forth. I thought, well, he at least revealed it to me. So then I filed a judicial misconduct complaint with the Seventh Circuit, and I put it all in there. Judge Posner was on the panel. Judge Posner disclosed to me that Judge Michael Caney had the case fixed. You need to do something about this. So then the chief judge of the Seventh Circuit, Diane Sykes is her name, so she writes up an order, and she says, oh, well, you know, this happened a long time ago. Witnesses die. Sometimes they're hard to get a hold of. and so forth. And she acknowledged that there's no statute of limitations on judicial misconduct complaints. So then, I file a petition to readdress that. This cannot be. You did not contact Judge Posner. You did not contact Judge Kaney. You did not get a denial from Judge Kaney that he had the case fixed, the decision fixed with Posner. You did not contact Judge Posner, who could have told you that what Kaney did in having the decision fixed. So you didn't contact him. That was just right then and there just absurd that you would not go to that judge and say, hey, listen, this person is claiming that you told him this. Is it true or is it not true? So this is court now. You know, you have to have evidence. You have to have information. But they chose not to ask him because they knew if Posner would have admitted to them what he told me, they were in big trouble. So this way they just whitewash it. So then I filed a petition to the Judicial Conference of the United States and explained to them how the Seventh Circuit swept it under the rug, didn't get any denial from Kaney, did not speak at all with Posner to get a denial or an affirmation of what he said about the case fixing. So it sat there, it's sitting there to this day. They're just sitting on it. That's how our judiciary works. That's how it works in this country against the citizens of this country. It's very corrupt and unjust and unfair, and we need to do something about it.
So I heard just a litany of false things that occurred and crimes against you for the past hour. You have detailed, you know, your experience with that. And what could be done to reduce or even eliminate judicial corruption?
Well, there's several things that could be done. For one thing, that needs to happen, when a judge commits a corrupt act and you file a complaint against that judge, now this can be in state court or federal court, there should be their brethren judges should not be reviewing judicial misconduct complaints against the judges that they sit beside every day, that they have offices next to, and a lot of times they're friends with each other. There should be independent investigations of those complaints, and there should actually be citizens on those complaints. That's one thing that could be done in terms of judicial misconduct complaints. And I might add, I've got the statistics on judicial misconduct complaints, and it's almost across the country. And I talk about this in my book in detail. I've got the statistics in there and the facts. Across the country, it's almost 0% of judicial misconduct complaints are affirmed. They almost always, 100% of the time, say no go. They don't discipline the judges. They're always ruling in favor of the judges. So that's one thing. And another thing that could happen that would be helpful. Now, I believe we all realize that, you know, judges can be impeached. Article 2 of the Constitution gives the U.S. House the power to impeach judges and assigns the power to try and impeach the U.S. Senate for trial. So we know under the Constitution they can be impeached. Now, the problem is the politics that comes into play. And another problem is this. You have to have, you know, to have an impeachment, you have to have the members of the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee be willing to investigate these judges and make recommendations, because it has to go to a full House vote and a full Senate vote. But the problem is the politicians, the U.S. representatives and the U.S. senators, they generally aren't on board with it. They're part of the government, and they don't want to hear it. it's very hard. Try to get a hold of your U.S. senator sometime. See if you can actually get a hold of your U.S. senator. Go on their website and see what you can do about contacting. You know, at best, you're going to get something from somebody from the office. You won't hear directly, and they'll just blow you off. It's almost impossible to make direct contact with them. So, and I did that. Actually, I contacted my U.S. senator here in Indiana. His name is Todd Young. Okay, I wrote a letter. You know, I told him. I said, "Hey, listen, I filed. You know, all this stuff happened in the Seventh Circuit. They whitewashed it. I filed a petition in Washington D.C. to the Judicial Conference of the United States, the Administrative Office of the United States. When I contacted them for a status, they won't give me a status. They won't make a determination here. I said I would like for you to contact them and get something done here." Oh, and then he says, I wrote a letter to, you know, on your behalf and so forth. Time goes by, nothing happens. So I contact him again, and then his aide tells me, well, the letter was written, we haven't heard back, you know, and so forth. So I said, well, you know what? I said, I'd like to see a copy of that letter that Senator Young said he wrote. And, well, we can't do that. We don't give those letters out to the constituents. I said, what do you mean you can't get? I said, I'm a constituent. I'm a taxpayer. These are all public employees, these judges, these administrative offices. That letter must be shown to me. It must be provided to me. They wouldn't give it to me. So how do I even know that a letter was written? I'm thinking it probably wasn't even written. But that's what happens. You know, these politicians are covering for these judges. They're part of the three branches of government, and they cover for each other. They don't want to get involved with anything going against a federal judge. So that's a problem. You can't get them to hold. You cannot get the House and Senate Judiciary Committee to hold investigations against judges because they have the power to bring them in and question them. Hey, this was brought to our attention. Here's the evidence that we have. Tell us about this. But they won't do it. That's the problem. We can't get them impeached because it's hard. It's almost impossible to get the Senate and the House Judiciary members to investigate them. They blow the people off. And so that's a big problem. And we have federal statutes. And forget about going to U.S. attorneys, because there are federal statutes. I have them all detailed in my book. There's federal statutes that when judges violate the Constitution, it's considered to be an act of treason against the country. That's right in the statute. So if you go to a law enforcement officer, hey, this judge violated the Constitution. He needs to be brought in and prosecuted. And if convicted, go to jail. But they won't do it. So we have laws on the books that protect the people. It specifically says it's an act of treason. So, but you can't get the law enforcement to do it either. They protect the judges. They're afraid of the judges. They don't want to make waves with the judges. But that's a disservice to the public. That's a disservice. And that's a big problem that we have. Now, another thing they could do that people may not realize is federal judges have lifetime appointments. Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution reads, the judges, both of the Supreme and Inferior Court, shall hold their offices during good behavior. And then it goes on. Now, and shall at stated times receive for their services a compensation which shall not be diminished during their continuation in office. So first of all, the judges have to act in accordance with good behavior to remain on the bench. Now, you know, we all know about Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. That certainly is not considered good behavior. So Congress certainly has an opportunity under Article 2, Section 1, to impeach both Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, but they're not doing it. Oh, we hear all these sound good things from the politicians and so forth, all that what they did was wrong. Well, then how come they're not impeaching them? Why aren't they bringing them in? Now, what a lot of people don't know is federal judges receive when they retire, they receive their lifetime pension is whatever their salary was at the time of their retirement, and all federal judges from the district court level on up are making well over $200,000 a year, not to mention all the other perks with the insurances and so forth. Okay, so they are all making well over $200,000. Of course, the appellate judges make a little bit more, and the Supreme Court justices make a little bit more. So one thing that could happen is that, now remember, Article 2, Section 1 says they should receive for their services a compensation which shall not be diminished during their continuation in office. So when they retire, they are no longer in office. So here's where we're at. The only reason they have a lifetime pension if they were making $220,000 a year as their salary, that's what their lifetime pension is. Now, who gets that kind of a pension other than federal judges, I might add? So the Constitution states under Article 2, Section 1, that they get that compensation, that their compensation should not be diminished during their continuation. So once they retire, it's a whole new ball game. The reason they have that type of lifetime pension is because Congress gave it to them. It's not in the Constitution. The Constitution says they get during their time in office, not afterwards. Congress gave them that, and Congress could take it away. So Congress giveth, and Congress can taketh. That's the bottom line. But again, the Congress won't do it. Congress could take away Clarence Thomas's lifetime pension at the same salary that he received. They could take Alito's away if they wanted to under Article 2, Section 1. They could do that. And if they looked into my case, they could have done the same thing with Caney. Of course, Caney didn't retire, but they could have done it if he would have retired. So this is the problem that we're having in the country. There's too much protectionism going on with, we have laws in effect that could help, and we have the Constitution in effect that could help. They can be impeached. Their lifetime full-time salary could be taken away from them. They could be imprisoned under the treason laws of the United States. It clearly states that if they violate the Constitution, and they violate the Constitution on a daily basis. And this is what happens. This is why we can't, this is why, what's happening is happening. The people are
so obviously the Congress doesn't have the capability of doing its job in this capacity. And it also appears as though it wouldn't work if judges police themselves. So in your opinion, should there be a citizen's oversight in this process?
There should be a citizen's oversight at every level of the process, from judicial misconduct complaints on up. Now just think, with what Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito is doing today, this very day, if there was a citizen panel that was brought before, as opposed to those politicians just sitting back and not willing to call them in and enforce the laws that could actually take place, if citizens had the ability to do it, citizens would do it. Citizens serve on juries every day. We trust our citizenry. They're on juries making decisions on people's lives and on people's freedom, all the time. So we trust the citizens in our jury process. But the system will not allow citizens to be involved in the process of investigating judges. So let's keep the citizens out of that, and let's just let the judges do that, take care of themselves, and then let's just let the politicians protect the judges. So our politicians, our elected officials are failing. They get an F in every way. They're failing in every way. We need, you know, I mean, we need a mass movement in this country. You know, like when we had the Black Lives Matter movement, it had an effect. You know, we have, you know, we've had other movements in the country that have actually had a positive effect for the people. We need a mass movement for this. We have people getting screwed left and right in civil rights cases, summary judgments. People's civil rights cases are routinely dismissed by judges. And almost in every civil rights case, a police case, employment discrimination case, or whatever, judges are dismissing cases. They're not allowing these cases to get to a jury. The judges are simply throwing the cases out and ruling in favor of the government or corporations. And in my opinion, that's actually unconstitutional, because the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution guarantees people to a right to a trial. Summary, the federal Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and the Seventh Amendment explicitly states, quote, "In suits at common law, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved." Well, then there should be no such thing as a summary judgment dismissal. A judge, according to the Seventh Amendment, doesn't have the authority. It has to be tried to the jury. That's the Seventh Amendment. So that would be bad behavior. That would be cause for impeachment. But where are the politicians that are in a position to do it? They won't do it. People are getting screwed in this country left and right on a daily basis. I asked the administrative office of the United States Courts. Rosalind Moskoff is the head of it. She was appointed by John Roberts. Tell me the percentage of cases across the country that are being dismissed. And then the response was, well, we don't keep those records. They don't want the public to know that the courts are probably dismissing 95% of those cases. They don't want the public to know that. You can't tell me they don't keep track. We're in an electronic day and age these days. They have records of all that stuff electronically, cases that are filed and cases that are dismissed. They don't want the public to know. This is why we, the people in this country, have to stand up, and we have to get out there, and we have to demonstrate in a very powerful way en masse. The politicians need to see it, and I'm not just talking about demonstrating against judges. I'm talking about demonstrating against these elected officials that are sitting there and ignoring the citizens and looking the other way. That's what we need to do. We need to have movement in this country. Otherwise, it's going to be the status quo forever. It's never going to stop.
So how many people are aware of what a summary judgment is? People may not realize that judges are unlawfully simply dismissing cases before they even go to trial.
Well, I would say probably very few people know what a summary judgment is, unless you've ended up in court and found out what it was the hard way. For the most part, most people just aren't going to know that. You'll know it if you're in court. If you're in a civil rights case, chances are your case is going to be dismissed on summary judgment. Then you'll know it. But for the most part, the people in this country who actually expect fairness in our judiciary and justice to happen, they don't know it. This is why we have to educate the public so the public understands. You know, the public is paying the salaries of the federal judiciary, not just the judges, but, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's a whole wide spectrum there, you know, with court officials and so forth. We're paying for all this. And we expect the judiciary to be fair, and it's not. When a civil rights case comes into court, it should go to trial. Case closed. It should go to trial. The Seventh Amendment states it. Trial by jury shall be preserved. Shall doesn't mean could be preserved, might be preserved. Shall means must be. Right to trial by jury shall be preserved. That's right in the Seventh Amendment. That's what people need to realize. That's why a lot of things are happening. I'm sorry.
It seems like the citizens of this country have a right then to sue the judiciary committees and people within the Senate and the House, as well as these judges.
Well, that's another problem. The citizens can't sue the judges and these elected officials because of the immunity that they have. It's virtually impossible under the way the law is set up. You cannot sue a judge unless that judge has done something like committed murder or something like that. But in that judge's official duties, you cannot sue the judge. They have immunity. They have 100% immunity for that, and so do the elected officials. You can't sue them.
So how do we force them to do the right thing?
We have to vote these elected officials out, and we have to make sure that when we vote them out, that we put officials in there who are willing to change the laws, because Congress put these laws into play. It's Congress who's done it. Congress are the ones that's given them all of this protection. They've given them the immunity and all of those other protective laws. It's up to the Congress to do it. So as long as we the citizens sit back and vote these people in and don't remove them, you know, whenever you have a problem in the judiciary and you contact your local U.S. representative or your U.S. senator and they blow you off, you should be on a mission to make sure that that congressman or congresswoman gets voted out of office the next time around. And then when elections are taking place, the candidates, we the public, should be grilling them. Hey, you never, ever hear, ever, during a Senate confirmation hearing, let me explain to your audience, the next time they watch a Senate confirmation hearing, tell them to pay very close attention. There's one thing that's never asked of any judge who's trying to become an appellate judge, or usually, you know, they always televise the Supreme Court hearings. They don't do it much with appellate and district court, although they have to have hearings with them as well. But the news media doesn't follow it like they do the Supreme Court. But whenever there's a Supreme Court confirmation hearing, they never ever ask that judge. Now, that judge is either a district court judge or a federal court of appeals judge that's trying to get on the Supreme Court. They never, ever ask that judge, how many cases have you dismissed, or in particular, how many civil rights cases have you dismissed during your time as a judge? How many were filed, and how many did you dismiss? They never ask that. And that's a question that should be asked, because the judge is going to have to say, well, during my time, there were 300 civil rights cases filed, and I dismissed 295 of them. Well, then that opens up the question, well, how could you possibly dismiss 295 out of 300 civil rights cases and not allow those cases to go to a jury that you would always rule in favor of the government or a corporation? How could that possibly be? See, they could grill them on that, but they never get asked that question. Again, that goes to the Senate. When you have Senate confirmation hearings, those are members of Congress. So this is the problem that we're having. They need to be ousted.
So beyond that, okay, I understand the election part, but again, we're in this catch-22 where the information is not being made public. We don't know how many cases they have dismissed. We don't know how many women that have been convicted, how many black people, how many Latino, how many white men. There is no public data. I just see these names of judges on the ballot when it's time to vote, and I have no way of determining what their record is.
Well, that's a big part of the problem. Now think about it. Whenever regular politicians, representatives, senators, they have debates. There's public debates, people can ask questions, and so forth. But when judges are on the ballot, there are no public debates. You know, if a judge is on the ballot, that judge should be required to stand up in front of the public and take questions from the public. But they don't allow that. And there's no law forbidding that. I mean, they have, you know, that's something they don't do. I mean, they can't go out. There's certain political speech that they can't do, But certainly they could answer questions about their record, just like they have to answer questions in front of Senate Judiciary Committee hearings. They could answer to the public, this judge is on the ballot, and the public has questions. That's another problem. That's why we need to put pressure on the elected official to put these laws into play where it's actually required instead of being disallowed. So the public has a big job to do here. You know, we as a country here, we're not really a true democracy. If you don't have a fair judiciary that actually serves justice, you don't have a true democracy. It sounds great. Oh, we have a democracy here in the United States. That sounds great. But if you don't have an actual true, honest, and fair judiciary, you do not have a true democracy. I'm sorry. We just don't.
So we need
all
a public information
campaign.
The
black people that are you know, there was a person, there was a black person in Cincinnati, Ohio, I was reading not too long ago, a few months ago. He served 32 years in prison, wrongfully convicted. 32 years later, because of DNA, they were able to discover that he didn't commit the crime. So, well, you know what? He was falsely accused, wrongfully convicted. What about that judge in that case? What about the prosecutor in that case? How come there's no repercussions against them? Now, sometimes, you know, the state will write a check. But you know what? When you're in jail for 32 years, there's not a check with enough money that can cover, you know, what you went through, a loss of your freedom like that. There should be an eye for an eye law in this country. Whenever a black person or any person ethnic, and I'm stressing black and ethnics because it mostly happens to them. Now, I'm white, and it happened to me, and it happened to whites, it happens to whites as well. But we all know for the most part it happens to the minorities. We know that. I mean, we have to call it out like it is here. I don't worry about the political correctness stuff. It's a fact. The minorities in this country get a royal screw job when it comes to courts, and there's a lot of minorities that are sitting in jail wrongfully just because of the circumstances that the judiciary allows itself to throw itself, you know, upon people in this country. And there should be an eye for an eye. Sits in jail for 15 years, wrongfully convicted because a prosecutor or a police officer or a judge disallowed evidence into the case that could and protected him from the wrongful charges, then those people should all be subjected to the same jail time. They should all have to serve the same amount of jail time, in my opinion. It should be called an eye for an eye law. If we have a person that comes, he's prosecuted, the prosecutor lies, submits false information, the police officer lies, the judge allows the lies, they should all have to serve the same jail time down the road after it's determined that person was wrongfully convicted. There's a lot of things that we could do, but the politicians won't do it. They have immunity. They've given them immunity. That comes from Congress. They have immunity. Congress can take that away.
So you're referring to qualified immunity, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so we need to have a massive public information campaign so that we inform the public about this. It appears as though the people that are motivated, I can see on Facebook, all these different groups, are people that have been victimized. And the rest of the people are like thinking it's Perry Mason time where the court system works. Or there are people that know some of this and just don't do anything. They're not active. So a very small percentage of the American population is actually fighting back against this injustice.
Absolutely. I mean, clearly, unless you've been involved in some aspect of it, a lot of people have the attitude, hey, listen, if it doesn't involve me, I don't want to be involved. Now, there is a certain part of the population, unfortunately, that's like that. But I also believe there's a good portion of the population that are actually good people, and they want to see fair things happen, and they don't want to see corruption taking place in our courts and in our system, that if they had the information, if they were educated enough, you know, a lot of people would say, well, I didn't know that. You know, they might join in as well. So I think there's a pretty good part of the population out there. If we could educate them, we could bring them in to the movement. We need a movement in the country. We need a strong movement to let the elected officials know we're tired of this. We're on to your game now. We don't like it, and we're going to change it. You're out. We're putting you out. We're going to vote you out, and we're going to only put people in that we know that are going to be on board with fairness and justice in this country, who are willing to actually change the laws in this country, take away qualified immunity. You know, they say nobody is above the law. Well, that's nonsense. They have immunity. How can you say nobody's above the law when you can commit a crime, but you have immunity to it under the law? You know, every time I hear somebody say nobody's above the law, I laugh. Judges are above the law, prosecutors are above the law, and elected officials are above the law. They all have immunity. So, therefore, they're above the law.
So, I mean,
the Seventh Amendment does not allow...
This is a ridiculous situation. But I have some callers on right now. I want to just acknowledge them. We're down to our last 30 minutes. I have a caller, 858-603. I'm going to put you on if you want to ask a question or say anything. Please identify yourself, what city you're in, and go ahead and say what you have to say, or you can just listen if you don't want to say anything. Hold on.
Thank you.
Caller 858-603, you're live now.
Thank you. And thank you, Walter, for putting this gentleman on. I didn't get his name at the beginning, but he's well-informed and needs to speak to larger audiences, not just to you. To get that movement started, you're right, we have to educate a lot more people than we do. Certainly at the schools and universities would be a welcome place to start that movement. We really need it to make changes to get progressives in there rather than the old established types that are protected with the immunity and so forth that are not making the changes that are necessary. So we need to spread you out and have more people like you teaching us what to say to the people that are entrenched and need to get out of there. And we need to get more young people willing to run for office. Of course, they have families if they're young and so forth, but we need more of that type in office to make the changes that are necessary. I really agree with you on that. And, Walter, you've said that.
Walter,
can I make a comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
The caller is made a great point. When we're talking about educating the public, the caller said that the schools and the universities should be involved in that process as well. That's a great point, actually, because, you know, we teach history and we teach civics and so forth in the schools, and we need to be honest in the schools and the universities and call it out and tell the students what the inequities are in order that those young people, when they're coming up, that they can be educated about this. So I just wanted to say the caller made a great point with that issue there. Very good.
And I want to help both of you guys. John, this is Brian Vukadinovich. He's a author, speaker, and an educator from Indiana. And Brian, this is John. He is an activist in San Diego County.
Hi, John.
Brian, do you have a book or material that you could start sharing to us online?
Yeah. Yes, I actually have two books. One's a very recent book. My first book was called Motion for Justice, I Rest My Case. And my just now recent book is called Rogues, R-O-G-U-E-S, in Black Robes, R-O-B-E-S, Rogues in Black Robes. And they're on, you know, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Walmart, all over the place. And also, I have a website that has a lot of my information about writings that I've done about judicial corruption issues and so forth and interviews that I've done. It's BrianVukadinovich.com. And you can see my writings and interviews and so forth on there as well. My books are on there as well.
Would you alphabetize your name?
Sure. B-R-I-A-N, Brian. Vukadinovich, V as in Victor, U-K, A-D as in dog, I-N-O-V-I-C-H. Brian
sure.
Vukadinovich, one word, .com.
Thank you, Brian.
You're welcome.
And just so everybody's aware, the links are in the description of this broadcast. So those websites are in there as well as ways of contacting Brian via Facebook and Twitter. Okay, Brian, so we had a caller, so we're getting out to people.
I like the responses.
Yeah, and there's been a couple of callers. People as far away as Palm Springs have called in. I posted this all over the place, so we should be getting people following up. So we really have to motivate people to get involved. It seems like there's a very concrete curtain of protection around our elected officials and the judiciary, and they're committing crimes, and they are committing crimes against the citizens of the United States, and that's being perpetrated because of ignorance and lack of action.
Absolutely, 100%. And there are laws on the books that address that. Judges and elected officials can go to prison under federal laws, but to do that, we have to have the law enforcement agencies prosecute them, and they won't. Now, elected officials could help. They could contact the people in the law enforcement, but they just won't simply, you know, it's so one-sided, it's unbelievable. It's considered, actually, under the federal statute, it's considered an act of treason whenever a judge violates the Constitution. And, I mean, there's all kinds of violations that are taking place on a daily basis. But the judiciary committees don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear about it. They don't want to deal with it. So as a country, we're basically screwed unless we stand up and speak out. That's what we need to do. We can. You know what? If you start putting some of these criminal judges in jail and some of these elected officials that are protecting them in jail, things would become more fair in this country. But as long as they know they can get away with it, there's no consequence for it. They're just going to keep doing it. They laugh. They have lifetime appointments. They can do whatever they want. They're protected. They have immunity. Elected officials won't step in and investigate, even though there are mechanisms to do it. It's a crime.
So it seems like we just need independent citizens committees to even be present in these different court settings to observe what is happening within the court, that we need to find a way to make that mechanism work, where we have citizens' oversight over all of these different cases and start to levy charges and collect evidence against these judges and corrupt officials.
Exactly. We need eyes in the courts. We need citizens in courts watching. We need them writing letters to the editor. Hey, I saw this. I witnessed this. This was wrong. We need a public campaign, letters to the editor. They need to contact their elected representatives. What are you going to do about this? Are you going to ask for an investigation? That's how we're going to get the movement started. And then we need the bottom line is, in the very end, we need citizens to actually be put on those boards, on those committees that are actually involved in the decision-making process. We cannot have politicians and judges simply overseeing each other and covering each other. It's imperative that we have citizens on those boards, on those review boards. Imperative.
So we need to find ways to hold the House and Senate Judicial Oversight Committees, responsible. We need to find ways of getting oversight of them. We also need to boycott companies that give donations to these corrupt elected officials. That's one of the most effective ways I've seen to bring people down like that. That's what happened with the Montgomery bus boycott, for example.
Absolutely. And, well, money, as they say, is the root of all evil, and money talks. And when that money starts floating into their pockets, it's talking. And that money's coming in from these corporations that, you know, hey, here's the money, you owe us a favor. Just like we see with Clarence Thomas and Alito right now. There's no denying it. There's no question about it. money talks. And consequently, the citizens get screwed. Absolutely. But the only way we can remedy that is by having the elected officials start doing some things with the law, eliminating some laws such as immunity and adding in laws where citizens are under the law to be on these panels. That's the only way we're going to do this.
So it seems like we need to have like another, for lack of a better term, another jury to oversee the court itself. I mean, so you have the jury that's looking at evidence, but we need to have a jury present to oversee the entire process.
Absolutely. A jury of the common people. You know, the all of the court cases involve the common people. And the common people are the ones that are getting screwed by the system. It should be the common people, and the common people are the jurors in these individual cases that are looking at the evidence. Those are the common people. So those same common people should also be the jury making the decision against what's going on with these corrupt judges. It should be the common people. They should be the jury. You're absolutely right. But they're left out of the process, and there's a reason for that. And we all know that reason.
So I do a lot of these stories, and I've even had situations where the court has basically said, we know that we have screwed you over, but if you tell anyone, we're going to hold you in contempt.
Well, that's the leverage that they have. You know, many judges are bullies. And when they commit acts of corruption or whatever, and they know they're caught, they know they have all this power, and people, for the most part, are in fear of the judges. They just are. And then, you know, a lot of them won't report it. And even when they do report it, they can't get any relief anyway. But most of them are scared because they know, if I turn a judge in or if I report this, that judge has got a lot of power. All he's got to do is call up this agency or whatever, and then my life becomes a holy hell after that. And absolutely, that's one of the problems we have. That's why we need oversight. We need oversight in this country, and it has to be citizen oversight. We cannot trust the judges. We cannot trust the elected officials. We know that. It's a fact. We need citizen oversight. But to get that citizen oversight, we have to have the elected officials pave the way for that, to put those laws in there. There should be laws enacted by Congress that whenever there's a problem with a judge, that there will be a citizen oversight that will review the problem, not just simply judges reviewing their brethren judges. That's no good. That's inadequate. It's wrong.
So there's a couple of mobile apps I want to bring to people's attention that can help get information. One of them is called Vote Spotter, and another one is called Contact Congress. And both of those have phone numbers that you can go straight to your congressional representatives, and you can send them emails and things of that nature. I would venture to say that sending a certified letter would be another way of making sure we get through to the congressman. Would you agree?
I would completely agree. In fact, I think that it's great to be able to call them and so forth, but you have the conversation and, usually it's a secretary or somebody on the other end or an aide, they hang the phone up and that's almost the end of it. But in writing, when they see it in writing, And it has a lot more force and effect, actually. And now, you have a written record of it too. If a person is being blown off by an elected official, he can say, "Hey, here's the letter I wrote." He can put it out to the public. The official can't deny it, and so forth. And if there was some kind of a debate on it, say, "Here's the letter I wrote to you. You blew me off. You did nothing." So it's always good to do it in writing. And a certified letter is all. Emails are really good too. I mean, it's a form of evidence of it, because a lot of times they hoodwink the public. Oh, well, that's not really what happened. So when it's in writing, that's always the best way. But I'll tell you what, another thing that's very effective, people that are having problems communicating with their elected officials, if they would write letters to the editor in those elected officials' hometown newspapers, see, they don't like that kind of publicity. That would have an effect. You know, if that congressman came into the office and said, well, anything today? And the secretary said, yeah, man, there's, you know, 40 people wrote a letter to the editor. They don't like what you're doing here. You know, you're not willing to help along with citizen oversight committees and so forth. There's a bunch of letters to the editor, and the public's reading this. That gets their attention. Otherwise, they just blow you off. People should be writing letters to the editor. Every congressman has a local district that they're from. They should find out who the local newspaper is, the dominant newspaper. Write letters to the editor about those congressmen. They hate that. That gets their attention. And do it over and over and over. Not just one time. Do it again and again and again. And have their friends do it.
So letters to the editor, perhaps even public service announcements by organizations?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of good organizations out there that are actually civic-minded. You know, they have websites, too, and you can put information on there. And I'm going to tell you, you know, if people look at my website, I've got tons of letters to the editor and op-eds that I've written. I mean, I've been published in the Washington Examiner and so forth. And I mean, people can read the letters to the editor where I put it out there. I mean, I slam them. And that's what people need to do. If they would look at the letters to the editor I wrote, that could give them a pretty good idea on how to go about it. And find out the friendly organizations and put the information on their websites, because a lot of these organizations, they have a lot of people that are looking at their websites and so forth. And they put press releases out. The bottom line is the politicians and the judges, they have to see their names published in, you know, whether it be on websites, whether it be in letters to the editor, op-eds, they need to see their names published when they do something wrong. That would have an effect. They have to see their names published, and that's what we the people have to do. We have to put that out to the public. We have to disclose them. We have to call them out publicly.
So perhaps one strategy might be to send these letters, to send the certified letters, to send the emails, make the call, and then when you get blown off, you know, do the public service announcement or letter to the editor saying, you know, Congressman blah, 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 I've contacted them on these occasions about judicial corruption, and they have not responded. Something of that nature.
Exactly. 100% what you just said. Exactly. Just like that.
So
that's what I've been doing.
We need to keep hammering this home to the public. So those of you listening, please share this with your family, friends, and constituents. And again, the website for Brian is right there on the description of this broadcast. And I'm going to be placing this on my blog as well to make it easy for you to dispense the information. We're down to our last 12 minutes, so I want to talk about upcoming events that you have coming up, Brian. You'll be participating in the Fall Festival of Writers event at the Vigo County Public Library in Terre Haute, Indiana.
Yes.
Was that correct?
Terre Haute,
Indiana. That correct?
Terre Haute.
Okay.
It's in southern Indiana, and they're going to have an author event, so I'm going to go there with both of my books. And I really enjoy those. You get to talk to the people a lot about things where you can actually enlighten them about a lot of things when you're talking about the subject matter in your book. So I'm able to talk to people about judicial corruption. So that'll be one way that I'll be doing it. I'll be at that event on October 7th, coming up not too long from now. And then in March, I believe it's March 7th, I'm going to go back to Terre Haute, and I'm going to speak there. I'm going to discuss my book and the judicial corruption and so forth. And it's my understanding there's going to be a pretty good audience there for that. So those are a couple of things that I've got coming up. I've done a lot of things in the past already. I spoke at the Martin Luther King Jr. celebration event. I think it was about a year ago. So we got to talk a lot on there about unfairness issues against minorities that are taking place by, you know, in the court system and so forth. So that was a great event that I was able to participate in. And I've done some television, radio, podcasts, and so forth. And I'll have some more coming up. And the one we did today here was great, and I really, really appreciate your invitation here, Walter. And let me add this in here as well. You know, I looked at your video that you have on your site, and looked at your experience, your military experience, and so forth, and what you were able to get out of the military experience, and also now transfer it now into what we're doing here now. The technology that you know now and that you're able to put in force and in effect into the greater cause now, what we're doing on exposing this corruption. So my hat's off to you, Walter, for what you've done as well. And I'm so glad that we made the connection here.
Excellent. I want to make the audience aware also that I just discovered a new app. It's called Five Calls for Congress, and it allows you to make telephone calls directly to your congressman regarding top issues. And so to reiterate, what we've been talking about is judicial corruption that's going unchecked. And we are talking about methodologies in which citizens can gain the power to overturn the roadblocks put in our way by the judiciary committees of both the Senate and the Congress of the federal government. And we need to be evaluating implied immunity, which gives judges and law enforcement officials immunity from crimes that they may commit, and it places them above the law. So there are lots of people that are above the law. And so we need to reverse this, and it's not going to take that many of us to do that. But the more we can get on board, the more powerful this can be. I want to bring to your attention also, you can visit the website opensecrets.org. There you can see the flow of money into the pockets of the politicians, who are the top contributors to the politicians. And then this gives us an ability to cite companies for boycotts. And we're going to have further presentations on how to conduct successful boycotts, but I recommend that you just look at the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. That's a classic example of how to be successful with carrying out a boycott, and it's got to be done over a long period of time. We've got a lot of work to do to bring ourselves into justice so that we truthfully have a democracy, but until this occurs, we're all under threat of having our liberties taken away from us and to become victimized. So what is it going to take for you to be motivated to do something? Do you have to become a victim? Does your family have to become a victim? Are you going to start working on this now before this comes to your doorstep? Some of you have already been beat down by this. I know I have, and I'm still fighting back. And so we have to fight back. It is not a choice that we have, and none of us want to fight. All of us want to be peaceful. We want to live our lives quietly. But as we saw with Brian, he was not able to do that. The police arrested him repeatedly, beat him up, and there were so many cases like that. The Stephen Harris story that I'm working on right now. Stephen Harris was incarcerated for 11 years with no trial, and now those prosecutors and police officers, coroners, all those officials there in Jackson, Mississippi, have lost their qualified immunity. So it can be done. We can win this. We have examples of this over and over again. Look at the wonderful work that Louisiana United is doing and Americans United International. We're getting fantastic things done all over the country, and we're going to be joining forces with Brian here to utilize his knowledge as an educator to help push us forward in our effort to achieve justice in this country. Brian, we're down to our last 5 minutes. Would you like to go ahead and close, add any additional things you have to say? Take 4 minutes, please.
Okay. Yeah. First of all, well said. Very well said what you just said. You boiled it all down to what we need to have out there. You did a great job with the statement that you just made. This is what we need to do. I know you're working hard on your end with it. I'm working hard on my end with it. And then when we coordinate our efforts like we're doing here, and we'll continue to do so, and we get the people out there united, we educate them as to what the problems are and let them understand that even though they might not have a direct involvement with these corruption issues, it still affects them in some way, shape, or form. First of all, as I said earlier, you know, they're actually paying the salaries of these people that are doing that, these government employees. So the people should be concerned. If we want a fair and just system in our country, we got to get people on board here, and they can't be afraid. They cannot be afraid. We have to stand up. Now, I'm going to use the example that I've used in many other talks that I've done. Rosa Parks, we all know the Rosa Parks story. And back in those days, how terrifying it must have been for her to say no. And I'm sure probably that her family and her friends probably told her not to do that. And we all know I'm talking about sitting in the front of the bus. I'm sure because, I mean, you back in those days, you would get lynched for that and that type of thing. So she had the courage to say, no, it's wrong, it's illegal, and it's unconscionable, and I'm not going to stand for it. You can do whatever you're going to do to me, but I'm sitting in the front of the bus. That's where I'm sitting. Now, my message is this to the people. Let's get to the front of the bus. Let's not be afraid. Rosa Parks could have really suffered a death consequence for that, or imprisonment and so forth. She was courageous enough to stand up and say, enough's enough. I'm not going to have it any longer. I'll take whatever I have to take, but here's my statement. I'm standing up and I'm going to sit in the front of the bus. So we need to stand up as a country and sit at the front of the bus. We cannot allow the elected officials and the corrupt judicial officials sit in the front of the bus and move us to the back of the bus as if we don't count. So we need to push them out of the front seats and put them at the rear of the bus, and we get to the front of the bus and say, we're not afraid. We know what you're doing. We're onto your game. We know what our rights are, and we're going to stand up for our rights. And if there's some consequences we have to face along the way, then so be it. But you're going to hear from us, the public. We demand change. We want to sit in the front of the bus. That's my message.
Okay, and very good. We're down to our last 2 minutes here. Again, I want to encourage everyone to share this with your family, friends, and constituents on social media. And I also want to advise you that we don't ask for donations and we don't charge people anything in order to do these interviews, but we are asking that you look at taking advantage of some of our services. We do wills and trusts, retirement plans. I have many different services that if you can support me by making a purchase, allowing me to help you with financial arrangements and getting financial tools, this will be very effective in helping me assuage some of my expenses for travel and other things and making these shows possible. Brian, I really want to thank you for the great information that you have put out. I'll be having very detailed information placed on my blogs, and I'll be sending out links to those, putting those on Facebook to make sure that everybody knows how they can support Brian. Please pick up his books. You can go to his website, the hyperlink. It's within the body of the description of this broadcast and will also be placed within the body of the blog postings. I want to thank everyone that's called in and everyone that's listening right now. We'll be continuing with Brian in the future. We're going to be doing some Skype calls and other things in terms of videos, as well as additional podcasts. Brian, thank you very much for your time in this. I really appreciate you.
Well, Walter, it was an honor to be on here with you. It was a great pleasure and an honor. I truly mean that. Thank you.
Outstanding. This is Walter Davis with Progress in the World Radio Show, coming to you from Southern California. And thank you very much.